Good afternoon. The time is 12:07. You're tuned to Midday Matters right here on 89.1 FM. I'm Sean Beter. Very glad to be with you on this Monday, January 28th. Today on our program, we're taking our first look at the ongoing 2013 Indiana legislative session. And with me to help with the discussion today, it's the usual suspect himself, Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. Bob, how are you today?
Well, after being preempted by first the governor and then the president, it's great to be back in the air.
We've had a not so many programs this year, a lot of interruptions from all levels of government, but now we're going to chat about them a little bit. So, Bob, we appreciate your patience, and thanks for coming back. With us today in the studio as well, two of the folks we invite in to chat politics and government when we have these programs. It's Andy Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IPFW. Andy, how are you today?
I am doing all right, Sean. Thank you very much for having me in.
And with us as well, it's Tom Hain, instructor at IPFW as well in political science. Tom, we're glad to have you back. How are you?
Pleased I didn't have to chip my way out of ice to get here today.
So that's right.
Happy to be here.
Unusually warm temperatures in the region today. Gentlemen, let's start. Let's hop back here a little bit. We have a new governor, Mike Pence, elected in November by a reasonably comfortable margin anyway. On the day of his inauguration, Andy Downs, 15 executive orders already getting to work on day one.
Well, that's something that governors like to talk about doing these days. They don't want to look like they're wasting time. They want to take advantage of the honeymoon period they do have, and executive orders are an easy way to do that. For those who don't know, executive orders basically have the full effect of law, but are not things that go through the General Assembly. They often are sort of mundane and maybe even boring. They're continuations of commissions that have existed before or those sorts of things. The ones that probably got the most attention this year, though, two in particular, one of them was an executive order that called for the creation of what were called family impact statements by certain departments and divisions within state government. And the other was one that called for no increase in regulation. And so those were two things that were discussed during the campaign, specifically mentioned as parts of the platform from Pence. He managed to do both of those on the first day, and so he can make claims that he is off and running immediately.
And Tom Hay, executive orders, like at this level of government or at the president's level, not the full force of law, but definitely can put limitations on the legislature, put limitations on what different departments in government can do, and sometimes very significantly.
Oh, certainly. I don't know what the cost of, for instance, the family impact statements will be. We'll have to see, what kind of manpower that takes to implement. It's something new that agencies have to deal with. Of course, there was a slight change in how education is handled as well. Took a little bit of power away from Glenda Ritz, which was notable since that's an area that we look for some tension between the superintendent and the governor. But no doubt these can be significant in terms of how the bureaucracies operate. This is where you've got the executive branch deciding how to implement laws that come from the legislature, and so they can be significant for sure.
And we do want to invite our listeners to join the conversation this hour. If you have a question or comment for our panelists, or you just want to share an observation about the session so far, we'd love to hear from you. The number 260-452-1185 or 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters at nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. Andy Downs, we did hear of course, Mike Pence's State of the State address. And these addresses for first-term presidents or governors strike me as a little odd, I guess, because, normally you think of the State of the State, somebody evaluating how their their constituency is doing, and also laying out proposals. This was, you know, Mike Pence didn't have a lot of time to put that speech together.
This is one of the interesting things about the way some state governments operate, ours in particular. The governor doesn't take office until early January, obviously, and then the State of the State address usually comes pretty quickly after that. But there is the time period from the election in November to that January time. So this is not like it's they aren't thinking about things to say leading up to the speech. Additionally, in some respects, a State of the State address for the first time someone gives one is a nice way to encapsulate what was said during the campaign, to talk basically about what was in the platform. And so we heard in this particular state of the state address, first of all, a nod to the previous governor that things are in fairly good shape compared to other states. And then from there, a list of things that Governor Pence hopes to do, many of which were part of campaign literature and commercials, et cetera. Some had a little more detail to them than before, maybe not a whole lot, but it's certainly an opportunity to remind people why they elected you.
And Tom, hey, any big surprises, anything that struck you as a little bit unexpected, I guess, during that that first big speech?
I don't know if there was anything strikingly unexpected. We got numbers to things that, mm-hmm. that we haven't had before. So, you know, we have numbers for the tax cut, how much Governor Pence wants for that. We have numbers for how wants to spend about $350 million, I think, on transportation, $18 million on career and vocational training. So we got some of those things. Maybe if there was one thing that was surprising, just because it was a little odd, was when he talked about pre-K programs and brought up the Busy Bees example. We know that the Busy Bees program was voted down in a referendum, and so using that as a place to start with pre-K was a strange element of the speech to me, but
yeah, but one that if you think about what the organization stands for, Mike Pence is somebody who's been willing to acknowledge the groups he supports. So, in some respects, it shows a little bit of independence too. You know, that he's not just going to follow blindly, but he will occasionally make a quote hard decision that he thinks is in the best interest of the community. And let's face it, if he wants to go down as one of the great governors, or if he is interested in other elected office, and of course by that I mean president, then he is going to have to show the ability to do things that are maybe not quite so popular. And when you say you want to do stuff that you are able to say is in the best interest of children, let's do it for the kids. I always tell students, if you can add "let's do it for the kids" to the beginning or end of a sentence, you've scored some political points. So it's you're right. Maybe was not the greatest place to start, but at the same time, one that shows a little independence, but at the same time in an area that's a fairly safe area.
Is that one of those phrases like Hoosier values that are just...
Oh, yes. You talk about Hoosier values and our kids, and you've scored really big points.
Hmm. We want to hear from our listeners today. If you have a question or comment for our panelists about the 2013 session and state government and how it's going this year so far, give us a call, 260-452-1185 or 800-471-9264. Andy Downs.
Or if you just want to call in and tell us what Hoosier Values stands for, preferably an acronym of some kind, I would appreciate that too.
No 2014 or 2016 candidates.
No. They need not apply. Salad, please. No. Yes.
If you can distinguish Hoosier Values from Washington Values, you've even better improved.
Also as an acronym, though. It's got to be as an acronym.
Right.
let's get back to the task at hand here. We've talked about Pence's speech. He, you know, Andy, you mentioned that he laid out a number of things that, you know, he laid out in the campaign, basically. Let's talk a little more specifically. Tom, hey, you mentioned, you know, the transportation, education, of course, the 10% income tax cut, a big part of probably the main part of Pence's equation for this budget year. Does that seem likely? We've heard Brian Bosma kind of and other, you know, House leadership kind of back away from that a little bit, saying we want to spend on other things.
What's interesting, in my opinion, about the 10% cut is that shortly after the election, both leadership in both chambers, in the Senate and in the House, said, yeah, we don't think so. And so people who thought that a Republican governor coming into a first year with a supermajority in both chambers was going to be able to get everything he wanted, are about to find out that that's not necessarily the case. Now, that doesn't mean that there won't be a tax cut, but the legislature sent a clear message to him, which was to remind him that in terms of institutional powers, he's actually fairly weak. Everybody who's governor of Indiana is fairly weak in terms of institutional powers, and the legislature actually decides what taxes are going up and down, and they will exert that authority.
And this gets back to something I think we've spoken about before, that in the broad view of United States governors, Indiana's is still in a relatively weaker position than others.
Yeah, there are several other elected officials at the executive level. They don't control a lot of the appointments to boards and commissions. There are other people who have some say in those things. Those terms are staggered, so it's not like they get to sweep everybody out, although some have tried on different boards and commissions. So it is institutionally relatively weak. Now, there have been some governors who, through their sheer force of personality, have been able to sort of up their ranking in the national scales. Mitch Daniels is one of those people. We can't say yet whether Pence has that ability. The markers usually come out sort of after a little bit of time, so it's too early into his time to say whether he's going to exhibit that force of will that moves him up the power rankings. But if you just look at the institutional powers, it's mediocre to lower in terms of powers for the governor.
Well, in addition to the institutional structure, there was the optics of there being a Republican response to Pence's State of the State address, which, Republican responses to themselves have become a trendy thing lately. But for them to respond and then later say, we agree with 95% of what Mike Pence offered. Well, if there's really a bone to pick, we're going to have to give Andy a sabbatical so that he's got enough time to keep track of all of the press conferences. But it was still, it said something about how Governor Pence and the legislature are starting off with each other, that they felt there was a reason to have this response time, even though for those of us who saw it, it was hard to see exactly what it accomplished for them. But it was symbolic, I guess.
Bob Kaler.
So for when you look at Mike Pence in the House of Representatives versus Mike Pence as a governor, these early indications of his style as governor, one seems more moderate than the other, wouldn't you say?
Well, you could say that, but when you are actually an executive, the realities of the situation impose themselves. And so it's really not that uncommon for a legislator who becomes an executive to have to moderate to some degree, because you're basically dealing with what the legislature hands you. So I don't really think that it's a fair comparison to say, for any executive, quite frankly, to compare exactly how they behaved as a legislator to how they behave as an executive. I think one is an indicator of what they might do, but the circumstances are just different. And I forget who it was, but somebody once said it's just the reality that as executive, you don't get to play in the idealized world any longer. Now you're in the real world dealing with these things that you find. So it is an interesting observation, but I think in some respects one that we maybe could have seen coming.
Although, boy, the real world of Indiana seems to be a much nicer place to be an executive than the real world of the federal government.
Yeah, I'm betting you'd find a lot of people who would agree to that.
A surplus?
Yeah, my...
We want to hear from you, our listeners, this hour. If you have a question or comment for Tom Hay or Andy Downs, we'd love to hear from you, 260-452-1185. Or you can always call us toll-free at 800-471-9264. Let's open the phones here and go to Daniel. Daniel, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Yes, good afternoon. So with the hotly contested, so-called and so-labeled right to work legislation, are there metrics or ways that the results of this are going to be measured, be it by jobs or capital invested or new businesses that come to Indiana, or might those metrics have to be described perhaps in this legislative session?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and it's indicative of several other issues. So, for example, when people were saying that vouchers were going to be good for education, it's something that when it happens, We don't know immediately its impact, and we do have to look at it in future periods, whether that's 1 year later, 3 years, 10 years, doesn't really matter. You can't
right.
you can't say right once it's done whether it had some great effect. As far as right to work goes, all you really have to do is go look at all the work that people cited during the argument, and whether that's change in wages, whether that's change in the number of people employed, the industries that come to locate in a state that is right to work, all of those are fair game. And so I think the question that I would ask if I were in Daniel's shoes is, what data is the state going to use to determine whether this was successful or not? Because regardless of what the state does, other groups, outside groups, will gather the data that they know has traditionally supported their position, and they'll impose that on what's happening here. But it's a great question to ask, how will the state decide whether this has been good for
right.
the state or not?
Right.
And somewhat anecdotally, I suppose, we're going to hear a report during the news break this hour from our State House reporter, Brandon Smith, basically saying that union membership is down over the last few years. And both sides, Democrats and Republicans, are saying that they're not really sure of the impact that right to work has had yet one way or the other. So it sounds like a wait and see approach, Andy Downs.
Well, certainly we have to wait and hear what the state uses as its official mm-hmm. numbers. The other groups, I'm pretty sure, have already started collecting data.
Yeah, and Mitch Daniels had made a point of wanting to raise per capita personal income, which went down during his 8 years here. And so, you know, there are a lot of different things that you can measure, and then what you're going to measure is always where the devil of the details are, whether it's right to work or education or any other standard that you're going to, you know, set a measurement and say this is what
right.
we're going to use.
Daniel, we appreciate your call and your question. Thank you
All
very
right.
much.
Thank you.
All right, have a good day. The number to get a hold of us and share your questions and comments this hour, 260-452-1185 or 800-471-9264. Before we go to a break here, I want to ask you both, any indication at all on how the state can measure this or will measure this? Do they have to measure the results on this? Tom Hay.
Well, they have to measure it some way, but I don't have an answer to that in terms of what they're going to use. Do you know?
No, obviously there's data that's already collected within the state, and
right.
they can simply point to those. So you pointed out already per capita income. They can look at unemployment rates, several other things. I actually will argue they don't, quote, have to measure it.
Yeah.
In fact, in some respects, if you're a fan of right to work, your best interest might be to not measure. That way, if the indicators are bad, perhaps even for reasons that have nothing to do with right to work, you don't have to say right to work might not have worked. So, you know, this may be one of those instances where, and I had this discussion with other people, the right to work issue, because of the volume of data that's out there, that good data too, I'm not talking about stuff that people are just making up, there are legitimate indicators that show that both approaches might be the right one. And so since that's the case, it becomes more of a philosophical argument. And philosophical arguments are hard to win with data because defining the terms can be so difficult. So I'll actually say to Tom, in some respects, I would say, no, let's just keep reporting the economic indicators we've already reported. Keep doing it. And if they happen to go up, we'll celebrate that they've gone up. And if they happen to go down, we will not mention that right to work was something that we did.
Or compare ourselves to other states. And,
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in fact, other states in our region have followed Indiana's lead already. Michigan, we heard just a few weeks ago, now a month ago, passed a similar legislation. We do need to take a break here. We do want to hear from you this hour. We're talking about the 2013 Indiana legislative session and the goings on in state government. The number to get in touch with us, 260-452-1185. Or 800-471-9264. Of course, our email is open, middaymatters@nipr.fm. Our Facebook page is up as well, and you can tweet us at Midday Matters. Stay with us. The program continues when we return.
The The abuse and murder of civilians was far more common in the Vietnam War than most Americans imagined, according to a new book by Nick Terse. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Terse about his book, Kill Anything That Moves. It's based on extensive research in military archives and interviews with both military veterans and Vietnamese civilians. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Singer-songwriter guitarist Ben Harper digs deep into the blues with the legendary harp player Charlie Musselwhite. We'll talk with Ben about what he calls his graduation album. Then a visit with avant-garde traditional New Orleans banjo player Carl LeBlanc. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Monday night at 7 on WBOI.
Saturday night at one of the nation's busiest hospital trauma centers. Patients with bullet wounds arrive just minutes apart.
Hold compressions, intubate, see if you have cardiac motion.
How smarter trauma care is saving more gunshot victims. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's weekdays starting at 4 on WBOI Northeast Indiana Public Radio. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Reinbold and Anderson, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Will your money last? With a retirement plan, it can. More information on Reinbold and Anderson on NIPR's homepage at nipr.fm.
It's 12:28. You're tuned to Midday Matters on 89.1 FM WBOI. I'm Sean Beter, along with Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel, and we're talking this hour about the 2013 Indiana legislative session and the goings-on in state government so far this year. Joining us in studio, it's Tom Hay and Andy Downs from IPFW, our usual political team, here to chat with us once again. And we do want to hear from you this hour. If you have a question or comment, it's 260-452-1185 or 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet at Midday Matters. Gentlemen, we talked a lot about Governor Pence and his inauguration, his speeches, executive orders, all that. We haven't talked a whole lot about the legislature specifically, so let's talk about the big priorities. Tom Hay, this is the long session. This is a budget year in Indiana. Let me ask you the most basic question. What does that mean?
Well, it means they've got more to do. It means that you've got some big things coming in terms of education. Certainly, that's 64% roughly of the budget. That was one of the things that you heard. You heard some things that there seemed to be agreement on. Then you heard some things where you could tell there was going to be a fight. And so for the agreement side, it definitely seems like we're moving forward with some pre-K funding. Now, what that's going to eventually take shape as in a final form, we're not sure yet. But there definitely seems to be movement on that, and movement on career and vocational training. Although Pence put forward, I think, something like $18 million over 2 years, and others have said, well, you know, that should be more. And there's a question of how that's going to be implemented in terms of these regional councils that'll work with local business, how that's going to, you know, how you're going to put those together. But those seem to be some things that definitely are in the pipeline. And then you've got things, well, school safety was something that Governor Pence said that he didn't get to because of time. There could be conflicts there. And of course, the broader educational questions that Glenda Ritz's election call into question regarding school reform and all that.
Basically, there's a lot more business to take care of than there is in the odd numbered years, more or less. Even though it seems like we've had some very packed and very dramatic sessions the last few years, this is the time of year when the legislature sets out our spending priorities for the next few years. Andy Downs, let's talk education first. I mean, this has been the issue on a lot of people's minds through other channels, be it charter schools or otherwise. The legislature, though, actually talking about adding a lot of money, or giving a lot of money to education, much more than they have in previous years.
Yeah, what a lot of people will say is they're actually just restoring funding that was cut before. So, the wording around the amount of money is always an interesting thing to see. And then there is the question of how those dollars will be allocated. And Tom has raised a number of very good points. The vocational training dollars, it's actually something that conceptually Superintendent Ritz is actually in agreement with Pence on there being a need for this. If you talk to people in economic development, they'll tell you they are looking for people not only with basic foundational skills, we'd call them math and reading and writing, but also much more specific to particular types of vocations. That's what they're looking for in terms of the job market today. That's obviously easier to do than a four-year degree. You can complete those sorts of trainings faster. But in the end, the question is, where do you put all the priorities? And one of the things that will be interesting is the amount of money that is maybe allocated to vouchers, whether there's an increase there or not. Obviously, there's some legal wrangling going on. And as I recall, 2 years ago, the annual poll that's done by the Bowen Institute showed that the public actually was not in favor of additional money going into vouchers. They weren't necessarily opposed to raising spending on education, but not necessarily into vouchers. As more charter schools and other schools have to show what their performance is, the amount of money, public money, that's going to be invested in them will come into question. And so, you know, the budget session is a long session. They're in session until April, and they actually don't finalize the budget until the wee hours of the last day. And they do that in part because they want to be using the most current economic data possible. And so for people right now who want to try to set priorities within the education portion of the budget or any other part of the budget, they should not think that they're out of luck. They actually now have from here until, you know, sometime in April to make that case as they make the two-year budget this year.
We have a couple of questions and comments from listeners here. I want to get to one from Rick. Rick called in, but couldn't stay on the line with us. Rick says, with the surplus that the state has, they're supposed to refund money to each taxpayer. In August, we heard a lot about this, but suddenly we've heard nothing. What happened to getting the tax money back?
Actually, that will show up, I believe, technically as a tax credit, not as an actual check to us as individual taxpayers. Sort of what happened there is once the decision was made, and that was the end of it. So there was not a whole lot of need to continue to talk about it. And so there's the short answer to that question. And every time we get above the magic threshold in the surplus, that theoretically is supposed to happen. Now, they did bump up the threshold, in part because everyone was shocked that we made it to the threshold as quickly and as easily as we did. And if people remember, and I'm betting Rick does remember this, when we realized we had more money in the surplus than was necessary to trigger the automatic, quote, automatic refund, unquote, there was actually talk of a legislator saying, well, wait a minute. We didn't think we'd get here this fast, so maybe we meant to make this a higher limit and we don't want to give the money back right now.
And Bob Kaler.
I've heard or I've read that some legislators have suggested that the tax credit is in play now, along with the request from Pence for an income tax cut. Like maybe you can have this or you can have this, but we can't do both of them, or we can do some combination of reduced cuts and credits on both sides.
Well, that's interesting. That's the kind of negotiation that goes on. You know, these are folks who, if you're on the Ways and Means Committee on the House side, the comparable committee in the Senate, you spend basically this entire session dealing with budgetary issues. And they get into subtle differences like this. So, you know, what's the difference between, to you and me as a taxpayer, what's the difference between a cut in my income tax or a refund that comes to me, especially when in terms of the refund, it's like $150 per person or something like that. It's not, you know, it's not a huge sum of money. It's a nice little chunk of change, but it's not huge. It's not going to make you go buy a house or anything like that. If you look at the individual cut per paycheck, if we got the full 10%, that's almost enough that some people may not even realize they're getting it. And if that doesn't change their spending behavior, then has it really helped to stimulate the economy the way it's supposed to? So you get into a legitimate and very interesting philosophical discussion about the best way to accomplish economic goals. Is a tax credit better than a refund of some kind? And on top of that, because we have to make it a little more complicated, what actually costs us more to administer? If you think about it, literally writing a check and mailing it to every taxpayer costs an awful lot of money. Allowing them to simply claim a credit on their tax return costs us a whole lot less money to administer, but it also changes the way the people are going to use the money. If you get a check in the mail, you might think, hey, this is great. Let's go, you know, go spend it. But if it's part of what you find in your tax return, you may say, well, you know, that's what they owed me because I overpaid, and you look at it differently.
Tom Hay, briefly, can you analyze the politics of this for me? Because traditionally, it seems like, you know, one side wants to talk about, you know, how to use this money that we have. Another side says, let's just give it back. You know, the taxpayers, citizens know better what to do with it. In this particular case, it seems like Democrats and Republicans seem to be largely in agreement that a lot of this money should go into programs that have been cut, like education, for example.
Yeah, some of the politics of it is, of course, Mike Pence wants credit for this income tax cut. You know, this is something that, he personally believes in, but if he is thinking about other office at some point, this is going to allow him to make claims of making Indiana the lowest tax state in the Midwest and things like that, where other politicians are probably thinking, you know, you get less credit for cutting taxes than you get paying for raising taxes, right? Voters punish you more for raising taxes than they give you credit for cutting taxes. And so they're saying, look, you know, we've been in this situation before of sort of elastic budgets, and we'd rather protect ourselves for the future so that we don't have to raise taxes and anger the voters there than we want to give them this labeled tax cut. And I agree with Andy that some of this is just an issue of who's filling out the paperwork, of which way the money is getting to voters. And then it's a question of who gets to take credit for it, or which program's getting credit for it. So I think that's how I see it, is this is a bit of a battle between Mike Pence and his legacy and what he wants to establish versus some legislators who are thinking about, you know, I don't want to be in a position of having to raise taxes later to offset something like this, when we can build in a cushion, which would make it less likely for us to need to do that.
We have a comment here from one of our listeners. And of course, if you'd like to email your thoughts to us, it's middaymatters@nipr.fm. And of course, we'd love to hear from you by phone as well. It's 260-452-1185. Or 800-471-9264. A comment here from Tim. Tim says, I'm surprised to hear the comments on performance metrics related to right to work or any other economic development initiatives. We have a wealth of such information through the Regional Partnership and through the Community Research Institute. You've even had those issues discussed on our program before. They exist and will be monitored. Is that data, gentlemen, enough? Is that what the type of data that the state's looking for? You know, the basically unemployment statistics, other metrics that we can get from partnerships and the CRI.
Well, that's actually that's the point that was made earlier. There are plenty of measures that already exist. We don't have to go looking for new measures. And so this is where, philosophically, if you were in favor of right to work, there are certain measures that have a tendency to favor right to work, and there are certain measures that favor non-right to work. So those who are looking to prove or disprove simply go grab the data that's usually most friendly to them. The point that we were making about whether or not there needed to be measures is different. We recognize we'll always want to know how an economy is doing, but whether the state wanted to identify specific measures that would allow it to say that right to work helped or hindered the economy, that's part of what we were talking about there. The point was that there's an argument to be made for not having measures specific to that, instead using the measures that are out there already because there are plenty of them.
Looks like we have a caller on the line here before we get to our break. Let's open the phones and go to Diane. Diane, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I have two questions. The first, Daniels had to give back to the United States government money that was given us to educate migrant children. Is Pence going to be in the same position? And two, a friend had mentioned to me that Daniels left Indiana the 10th most polluted state in the nation. I was wondering if Pence intends to address this issue.
Gentlemen, let's...
Listen offline.
Thank you very much for your questions, Diane. Gentlemen, we haven't heard, as I recall, a lot so far either on migrant or immigrant issues in Indiana or about environmental issues from Governor Pence. Can you add anything to Diane's questions?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't know anything about the migrant worker issue. It does happen from time to time that states do have to refund money because they don't run a particular program or don't run a program in a particular way and therefore have to, or for that matter, meet enough workers or, in the case of that one, train enough workers to earn the money that came here, and so it does have to be refunded. But I don't know the specifics of this one, so I can't mention it. And then as far as environmental issues are concerned, I want to take people back to the first year of the Daniels administration, and he was quoted as having said to people in the Environmental Department, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, that they were the ones who could make some of the biggest differences in our economic prosperity. And his point was that a poor Indiana will never be a green Indiana. His philosophy was that in order for people to be interested in the environment, they have to have jobs that pay them good wages, and then they will take on the other issues. And there's something to be said for that point of view. If you look at public opinion polls, issues like the environment have a tendency to rank higher during good economic times than during bad economic times. In other words, I need a job today, so if it means a spotted owl doesn't have a home, then a spotted owl doesn't have the home. I should beat the spotted owl in the competition. It is very likely, given Pence's desire to reduce regulation, which is one of the executive orders he signed, that he will continue a number of the policies that had been put forth by the Daniels administration in that vein. Whether that actually results in a more polluted or less polluted state, that's one of those things that unfortunately we have to look at a bit in hindsight. There are some best practices that can be used, but you know, we see the effect of these things months and years down the road, not the same day.
I'm Bob Kaler.
Well, for a spot of context, it's that sounds about right. Say that Indiana might be the 10th most polluted state, and it was probably about the 10th most polluted state 20 years ago as well.
And we're a manufacturing state, we're going to produce more
lots of heavy industry, lots of coal-powered electric plants.
We do need to take a break here for the news, but we want to hear from you and your thoughts on how the 2013 Indiana legislative session is going so far. The number, 260-452-1185 or 800-471-9264. Of course, you can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. Stay with us. The program continues in just a few minutes.
Saturday night at one of the nation's busiest hospital trauma centers. Patients with bullet wounds arrive just minutes apart.
Hold compressions, intubate, see if you have cardiac motion.
How smarter trauma care is saving more gunshot victims. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News. That's weekdays starting at 4 on WBOI Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Northeast Indiana Public Radio. I'm Sarah D'Elia with WBOY News. An Indiana high school's collection of paintings by artists including Pablo Picasso and Claude Monet is being displayed at the Fort Wayne Museum of Art. More than 50 pieces collected by 1913 Peru High School graduate G. David Thompson are included in the Hidden Treasures exhibit. Museum Executive Director Charles Shepard tells television station Wayne TV that Thompson began buying art while leading steel companies in the 1940s. He decided to donate the pieces to his alma mater after becoming frustrated by negotiations with some potential sellers. Shepard says many of the works cannot be found anywhere else. The paintings will be on display at the museum until February 24th. Peru High School is building a gallery on its campus so it can display the collection permanently. The fears of opponents of Indiana's right-to-work law appear to be bolstered by statistics showing a significant decrease in the state's union membership since 2011. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, leaders on both sides of the debate say right-to-work likely had little effect.
Union membership in Indiana dropped about 20% from 2011 to 2012, just as Indiana's right-to-work law, which prohibits union contracts that require workers to pay dues for representation, went into effect. But Indiana AFL-CIO President Nancy Guyot says there are other factors at play which contributed to the drop in membership.
The squeezing of many public service jobs quite clearly seems to be at risk. That's just people losing their jobs. If they had those jobs, they'd probably choose to be union members.
Carmel Republican Representative Jerry Torr, who authored the Right to Work measure, says a membership decline can be both positive and negative. On one side, he says there are some unions that provide valuable training and services for their members.
And there are some unions that unfortunately tend to just siphon money off so the fat cats can go vacation and don't provide that much service.
Torr says Right to Work will help workers unhappy with their union voice that unhappiness by declining to pay dues. Guyot says every union in Indiana benefits its workers and the community at large by helping provide higher wages and better working conditions. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
Indiana lawmakers are again taking up a proposed state constitutional amendment that would guarantee the right of residents to hunt, fish, and farm. The state Senate's Agriculture Committee was scheduled to hold a public hearing on the proposal Monday morning at the State House. Republican Senator Brent Steele of Bedford says he is sponsoring the amendment in reaction to animal rights activists who he believes are trying to interfere with legal hunting and livestock production. Steele's resolution calls hunting and farming a valued part of Indiana's heritage and that they should be forever preserved. Both the Senate and the House approved the proposed amendment by wide margins during the 2011 session. If the same version is approved by lawmakers this year, it would go before voters for a statewide referendum in 2014. You're listening to 89.1 FM, WBOY Fort Wayne. Now back to Midday Matters.
Minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock. This is Midday Matters on 89.1 FM. I'm Sean Beter. Thanks very much for being with us on this Monday. Joining us in studio, it's Bob Kaler, one of our usual suspects. Bob, we appreciate you being with us once again. Also with us this hour, it's Andy Downs and Tom Hay from IPFW. We appreciate you guys being with us as well. And thanks so much to our listeners who have called with their questions and comments. I do want to move on. We haven't gotten to nearly as many topics as always happens here.
I was going to say, we never do, Sean.
we never, ever do. One of the big issues, beyond education, though, is transportation infrastructure costs. And I haven't heard a whole lot of argument so far from either side on how much money or how that money should be allocated. One thing's for sure, though, and Andy Downs, we can start with you. The major moves money, Governor Daniels' big plan, has that money's all gone.
Gone or committed. I mean, as we all know, it wasn't literally all spent. Some of it's in a trust fund that's spinning off revenue that's supposed to be used for these sorts of for transportation enhancement projects. But the reality is, that money disappeared pretty quickly. And so now we've got to figure out what we're going to do. For a lot of people, the answer is, well, how can this be a problem? We have more people living in the state, driving more cars than we ever had before. But what we have to remember is they're driving more fuel-efficient cars. And back when we saw gas prices go up to $4, we saw a lot of people curtail their driving experiences. In fact, as I recall, Mr. Kaler changed his mode of transportation for a while for mileage reasons.
Four wheels to two.
Yeah. So, you know, those things, when you realize that the roads are paid for because of gasoline tax, well, that's a problem when the tax goes down. And remember, people who are buying a Prius or a Volt or a, you know, any of those others, it's not only. In fact, I think it's Texas right now that's looking at a new kind of tax for electric vehicles because they will not be paying any tax through gasoline tax. But there is certainly no disagreement anywhere that the amount of money available is not sufficient to maintain the infrastructure we have and to add the improvements that people think are necessary. The question is how to raise that extra revenue.
Tom, hey, this is one of those issues, unlike education or right to work, many of these other issues that people are more passionate about, transportation infrastructure don't often get a lot of, not necessarily a lot of press, but they're not as sexy, I guess, for politicians who want to make a splash with voters.
Well, until it's your roads that are falling apart,
right.
and or benefited by projects. They're trying to finish the 69 project. They need to find the money for that. So it's not that there aren't some real pressing needs there, but yeah, Major Moves was this way to do some things in a novel way, and now you're back to trying to find the money, and they've talked about the surplus being a potential place to get some of that money, or this would be one of the things that would compete with the tax cut if they go forward with that, and the way you hear some hesitation on the tax cut from people in the legislature is they don't want it. It's sort of similar to what we said before, that you know, politicians have to worry about when people punish them for things, you know, and so you know, it isn't that sexy to say, here's some new transportation spending, but it's really bad to find yourself at the mercy of angry voters who have a bridge fall apart and, you know, create a catastrophe or just an inability to keep up with the kind of road upkeep you would expect when you go from 12 below zero to 60 degrees within the span of 2 weeks. That's usually not good for asphalt. So, you know, there's always repairs. And
I'm Bob Kaler.
I think something that's helping drive this as an issue in the General Assembly is that local elected officials are emphasizing it in almost every community. They're aching for road money, and they're making sure that it's on, that it's an issue up in front of legislators.
Yeah, and there is a moment that makes it a little sexy, and that's when they're cutting the ribbon because of a new road or new bridge or something. But that's fleeting.
I think most recently in our area was the Fort Support project, one of the last big major moves projects, at least while Governor Daniels was still in office. I do want to get to some other legislative issues before we have to go here. One of the big topics so far this session, casinos. Indiana, if I recall correctly, a top five state for gaming in the United States, number three perhaps, but a lot of challenges now from Illinois, from Ohio, other neighboring states. This is a major revenue issue, and Andy Downs, let's start with you on this. What are legislators trying to do to stave off this these challenges from elsewhere in the Midwest?
When revenue starts to fall, you look for ways to sort of stop the bleeding. And gaming revenue, in part because of surrounding states taking on more gaming, is dwindling in the state of Indiana. And so the goal is to find a way to increase that. Now, of course, when you discuss gaming, you end up talking about moral issues as well. And for a lot of people, they say, well, you never should have gotten into gambling to begin with for the moral reasons, for addiction, et cetera. But we're here. We use it. And now, unless you want to see other taxes go up, it is a vital part of the revenue stream for state government. And as it shrinks, we've got to figure out a way to shore it up or replace it with something else or cut. And those are the three options.
And last we've heard, there was momentum behind this bill to incentivize, you know, more job creation, more live dealers in racinos, things like that. But Tom Hay, David Long, the president pro tem in the Indiana Senate, has said that he's not so sure that this bill is the right answer. More rifts forming on these issues in the legislature, even in one party.
Could be, yeah. You start to look at these things like making it so that they don't have to be technically river boats or allowing different kinds of casinos. But frankly, I mean, this is money that's coming in because you've got tourists coming from other states. And if those other states have their own gaming and people aren't going to come, then you're going to lose that money most likely. You know, there's only so much you can do to compete with, say, Las Vegas and Atlantic City. So it's really kind of a regional activity. And, you know, they may be worried, not just as, of course, Andy said, there's the moral component here of how all in with gambling do you want to go. But there's also the issue of this being such a fleeting revenue stream that if you plan for it being there, but all you need to have for it to go away is somebody next door to change their state regulations, then it puts you in a very insecure place as a budget, as a official doing budgeting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Last legislative question here or issue question. We haven't heard a lot about guns so far in Indiana. What should be done, or if anything needs to be done to change the rules in terms of who gets a gun, how they get it, things like that. Tom Hay, your take on whether or not we'll get anything done or if anybody's talking about getting anything done in this session.
There's been some talk about moving forward with the school safety proposals from the NRA, but that's very, very, very much in the early stages. I expect this to be mostly a reactionary kind of legislation. It depends on what comes out of the federal level and what either legislators or the governor sees as needed in terms of a response. And so, you know, we may not see what's going to happen at the state level until we know, are you going to get anything on assault weapons or magazine capacity or background checks at the federal level? Because a lot of the things, I mean, at the state level, we've already gotten some changes in the concealed carry laws in Indiana and where you can exercise that. So I'm not sure that there's a whole lot for them to do in terms of the personal right. There may be the school safety stuff, but I expect it mostly to be in response to federal legislation.
I think that's probably pretty accurate. The state of Indiana has actually loosened up several items in the last couple of years. So throw on top of that the fact that you know, we're a state where there are a lot of gun owners. We're not going to be in a big hurry to restrict access to them. And it probably will be, as Tom said, much more reactionary to what happens at the federal level. In fact, let's remember there is a piece of legislation pending right now that would allow people to carry on campuses and other on public institution campuses as well as in other government buildings. And just a year ago, 2 years ago, I can't remember which now, the General Assembly usurped the power of local governments to actually have more stringent controls on guns. So I don't see the opposite happening here anytime soon.
Before we have to go here, a quick comment from one of our listeners. Daniel wrote in to say, I'm glad that we as a region, county, city have good data. I have high hopes for our region, and as I am myself an aspiring entrepreneur with ideas for opportunities unique for us. But I've lived in neglected areas of other states, and this legislation is statewide. This is in response to Right to Work. This legislation is statewide in scope. We're doing our best, and I know that this is a quote-unquote Hoosier value.
Well, I'm glad he brought up Hoosier values, but I also want to make sure we give some credit to the Community Research Institute and other bodies like that that gather data. They do a great service to the community.
We are out of time for this hour of Midday Matters. Tom Hay, Andy Downs, thank you both for being with us during this hour. Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel, thank you as well. Thanks to our listeners for listening and for getting in touch with us. I'm Sean Beter, and this is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, WBOI Fort Wayne. It's 1 o'clock.